Sixth day. Underscore on the sixth day are related the deceits practiced by man on woman, woman on man, or woman on woman, through greed, revenge, and wickedness underscore. Tilly underscore. Underscore because he would not have his son make a poor marriage, the Duke of Urbino, contrary to the promise given to his wife, hanged a young maiden by whom his son was wont to inform his sweetheart of the love he bore her underscore. The Duke of Urbino, called the prefect, the same that married the sister of the first Duke of Mantua, had a son of between 18 and 20 years of age, who was in love with a girl of an excellent and honorable house, sister to the abbot of Fars. And since, according to the custom of the country, he was not free to converse with her as he wished, he obtained the aid of a gentleman in his service, who was in love with a very beautiful and virtuous young damsel in the service of his mother. By means of this damsel he informed his sweetheart of the deep affection that he bore her, and the poor girl, thinking no harm, took pleasure in doing him service, believing his purpose to be so good and virtuous that she might honorably be the carrier of his intentions. But the Duke, who had more regard for the profit of his house than for any virtuous affection, was in such great fear lest these dealings should lead his son into marriage, that he caused a strict watch to be kept, whereupon he was informed that the poor damsel had been concerned in carrying some letters from his son to the lady he loved. On hearing this he was in great wrath, and resolved to take the matter in hand. He could not, however, conceal his anger so well that the maiden was not advised of it, and knowing his wickedness, which was in her eyes as great as his conscience was small, she felt a wondrous dread. Going therefore to the Duchess, she craved leave to retire somewhere out of the Duke's sight until his passion should be past, but her mistress replied that, before giving her leave to do so, she would try to find out her husband's will in the matter. Very soon, however, the Duchess heard the Duke's evil words concerning the affair, and, knowing his temper, she not only gave the maiden leave, but advised her to retire into a convent until the storm was over. This she did as secretly as she could, yet not so stealthily but that the Duke was advised of it. Thereupon, with pretended cheerfulness of countenance, he asked his wife where the maiden was, and she, believing him to be well aware of the truth, confessed it to him. He feigned to be vexed thereat, saying that the girl had no need to behave in that fashion, and that for his part he desired her no harm. And he requested his wife to cause her to come back again, since it was by no means well to have such matters noised abroad. The Duchess replied that, if the poor girl was so unfortunate as to have lost his favor, it were better for a time that she should not come into his presence. However, he would not hearken to her reasonings, but commanded her to bid the maiden return. The Duchess failed not to make the Duke's will known to the maiden, but the latter, who could not but feel afraid, entreated her mistress that she might not be compelled to run this risk, saying that she knew the Duke was not so ready to forgive her as he feigned to be. Nevertheless, the Duchess assured her that she should take no hurt, and pledged her own life and honor for her safety. The girl, who well knew that her mistress loved her, and would not lightly deceive her, trusted in her promise, believing that the Duke would never break a pledge when his wife's honor was its warranty. And accordingly she returned to the Duchess. As soon as the Duke knew this, he failed not to repair to his wife's apartment. There, as soon as he saw the maiden, he said to his wife, "So such a one has returned," and turning to his gentlemen, he commanded them to arrest her and lead her to prison. At this the poor Duchess, who by the pledging of her word had drawn the maiden from her refuge, was in such despair that, falling upon her knees before her husband, she prayed that for love of herself and of his house he would not do so foul a deed, seeing that it was in obedience to himself that she had drawn the maiden from her place of safety. But no prayer that she could utter availed to soften his hard heart, or to overcome his stern resolve to be avenged. Without making any reply, he withdrew as speedily as possible, and, foregoing all manner of trial, and forgetting God and the honor of his house, he cruelly caused the hapless maiden to be hanged. I cannot undertake to recount to you the grief of the Duchess. It was such as beseemed a lady of honor in a tender heart on beholding one, whom she would fain have saved, perish through trust in her own plighted faith. Still less is it possible to describe the deep affliction of the unhappy gentleman, the maiden's lover, who failed not to do all that in him lay to save his sweetheart's life, offering to give his own for hers, but no feeling of pity moved the heart of this Duke, whose only happiness was that of avenging himself on those whom he hated. Thus, in spite of every law of honor, was the innocent maiden put to death by this cruel Duke, to the exceeding sorrow of all that knew her. See, ladies, what are the effects of wickedness when this is combined with power. I had indeed heard, said Longarin, that the Italians were prone to three especial vices, but I should not have thought that vengeance and cruelty would have gone so far as to deal a cruel death for so slight a cause. Longarin, said Saffredent, laughing, you have told us one of the three vices, but we must also know the other two. If you did not know them, she replied, I would inform you, but I am sure that you know them all. From your words, said Saffredent, it seems that you deem me very vicious. Not so, said Longarin, but you so well know the ugliness of vice that, better than any other, you are able to avoid it. Do not be amazed, said Simontault, at this act of cruelty. Those who have passed through Italy have seen such incredible instances, that this one is in comparison but a trifling peccadillo. Ay, truly, said Gipuron. When Rivolta was taken by the French, there was an Italian captain who was esteemed a knightly comrade, but on seeing the dead body of a man who was only his enemy and that being a Guelph he was opposed to the Ghibellines, he tore out his heart, broiled it on the coals and devoured it. And when some asked him how he liked it, he replied that he had never eaten so savory or dainty a morsel. Not content with this fine deed, he killed the dead man's wife, and tearing out the fruit of her womb, dashed it against a wall. Then he filled the bodies both of husband and wife with oats and made his horses eat from them. Think you that such a man as that would not surely have put to death the girl whom he suspected of offending him? It must be acknowledged, said Ennasuite, that this Duke of Urbino was more afraid that his son might make a poor marriage than desirous of giving him a wife to his liking. I think you can have no doubt, replied Simontault, that it is the Italian nature to love unnaturally that which has been created only for nature's service. Worse than that, said Hircan, they make a god of things that are contrary to nature. And there, said Longarin, you have another one of the sins that I meant, for we know that to love money, excepting so far as it be necessary, is idolatry. Parlamente then said that St. Paul had not forgotten the vices of the Italians, and of all those who believe that they exceed and surpass others in honor, prudence and human reason, and who trust so strongly to this last as to withhold from God the glory that is his due. Wherefore the Almighty, jealous of his honor, renders those who believe themselves possessed of more understanding than other men, more insensate even than wild the beasts, causing them to show by their unnatural deeds that their sense is reprobate. Longarin here interrupted Parlamente to say that this was indeed the third sin to which the Italians were prone. By my faith, said Nomrified, this discourse is very pleasing to me, for, since those that possess the best trained and acutest understandings are punished by being made more witless even than wild beasts, it must follow that such as are humble, and low, and of little reach, like myself, are filled with the wisdom of angels. I protest to you, said Oisel, that I am not far from your opinion, for none is more ignorant than he who thinks he knows. I have never seen a mocker, said Gibiron, that was not mocked, a deceiver that was not deceived, or a boaster that was not humbled. You remind me, said Simontault, of a deceit which, had it been of a seemly sort, I would willingly have related. Well, said Oisel, since we are here to utter truth, I give you my vote that you may tell it to us whatsoever its nature may be. Since you give place to me, said Simontault, I will tell it you. Tale 52. _An apothecary's man, espying behind him an advocate who was to plague him, and on whom he desired to be revenged, dropped from his sleeve a lump of frozen ordure, wrapped in paper like a sugar loaf, which a gentleman who was with the advocate picked up and hid in his bosom, and then went to breakfast at a tavern, whence he came forth with all the cost and shame that he had felt to bring upon the poor varlet. _Near the town of Alençon there lived a gentleman called the Lord of La Tirelire, who one morning came from his house to the town afoot, both because the distance was not great and because it was freezing hard. When he had done his business, he sought out a crony of his, an advocate named Anthony Backair, and, after speaking with him of his affairs, he told him that he should much like to meet with a good breakfast, but at somebody else's expense. While thus discussing, they sat themselves down in front of an apothecary's shop, where there was a varlet who listened to them, and who forthwith resolved to give them their breakfast. He went out from his shop into a street whither all repaired on needful occasions, and there found a large lump of ordure standing on end, and so well frozen that it looked like a small loaf of fine sugar. Forthwith he wrapped it in handsome white paper, in the manner he was wont to use for the attraction of customers, and hid it in his sleeve. Afterwards he came and passed in front of the gentleman and the advocate, and, letting the sugar loaf fall near them, as if by mischance, went into a house whither he had pretended to be carrying it. The Lord of La Tirelire hastened back with all speed to pick up what he thought to be a sugar loaf, and just as he had done so the apothecary's man also came back looking and asking for his sugar everywhere. The gentleman, thinking that he had cleverly tricked him, then went in haste to a tavern with his crony, to whom he said, "Our breakfast has been paid for at the cost of that varlet." When he was come to the tavern, he called for good bread, good wine, and good meat, for he thought that he had wherewith to pay. But whilst he was eating, as he began to grow warm, his sugar loaf in its turn began to thaw and melt, and filled the whole room with the smell peculiar to it, whereupon he, who carried it in his bosom, grew wroth with the waiting woman, and said to her, "You are the filthiest folks that ever I knew in this town, for either you or your children have strewn all this room with filth." "By Saint Peter," replied the woman, "there is no filth here unless you have brought it in yourselves." Thereupon they rose, by reason of the great stench that they smelt, and went up to the fire, where the gentleman drew out of his bosom a handkerchief all dyed with the melted sugar, and on opening his robe, lined with fox skin, found it to be quite spoiled. And all that he was able to say to his crony was this: "The rogue whom we thought to deceive has deceived us instead." Then they paid their reckoning and went away as vexed as they had been merry on their arrival, when they fancied they had tricked the apothecary's varlet. Often, ladies, do we see the like befall those who delight in using such cunning. If the gentleman had not sought to eat at another's expense, he would not have drunk so vile a beverage at his own. It is true, ladies, that my story is not a very clean one, but you gave me license to speak the truth, and I have done so in order to show you that no one is sorry when a deceiver is deceived. "It is commonly said," replied Hyrcan, "that words have no stink, yet those for whom they are intended do not easily escape smelling them." "It is true," said Oisel, "that such words do not stink, but there are others which are spoken of as nasty, and which are of such evil odor that they disgust the soul even more than the body is disgusted when it smells such a sugar loaf as you described in the tale." "I pray you," said Hyrcan, "tell me what words you know of so foul as to sicken both the heart and soul of a virtuous woman." "It would indeed be seemly," replied Oisel, "that I should tell you words which I counsel no woman to utter." "By that," said Saffredent, "I quite understand what those terms are. They are such as women desirous of being held discreet do not commonly employ. But I would ask all the ladies present why, when they dare not utter them, they are so ready to laugh at them when they are used in their presence." Then said Parlamente, "We do not laugh because we hear such pretty expressions, though it is indeed true that everyone is disposed to laugh on seeing anybody stumble or on hearing anyone utter an unfitting word, as often happens. The tongue will trip and cause one word to be used for another, even by the discreetest and most excellent speakers. But when you men talk viciously, not from ignorance, but by reason of your own wickedness, I know of no virtuous woman who does not feel a loathing for such speakers, and who would not merely refuse to hearken to them, but even to remain in their company."
"That is very true," responded Gipuron. "I have frequently seen women make the sign of the cross on hearing certain words spoken, and cease not in doing so after these words had been uttered a second time."
"But how many times," said Simontault, "have they put on their masks in order to laugh as freely as they pretended to be angry?"
"Yet it were better to do this," said Parlamente, "than to let it be seen that the talk pleased them."
"Then," said Dagosin, "you praise a lady's hypocrisy no less than her virtue?"
"Virtue would be far better," said Longarin, "but, when it is lacking, recourse must be had to hypocrisy, just as we use our slippers to disguise our littleness. And it is no small matter to be able to conceal our imperfections."
"By my word," said Hyrcan, "it were better sometimes to show some slight imperfection than to cover it so closely with the cloak of virtue."
"It is true," said Denisutke, "that a borrowed garment brings the borrower as much dishonor when he is constrained to return it as it brought him honor whilst it was being worn, and there is a lady now living who, by being too eager to conceal a small error, fell into a greater."
"I think," said Hyrcan, "that I know whom you mean. In any case, however, do not pronounce her name."
"Ho, ho," said Gipuron, "to Ennasuite, I give you my vote on condition that when you have related the story you will tell us the names. We will swear never to mention them."
"I promise it," said Ennasuite, "for there is nothing that may not be told in all honor."
Tale 53. Underscore by her dissimulation the Lady of Neufchâtel caused the Prince of Belos to put her to such proof that it turned to her dishonor underscore. King Francis I was once at a handsome and pleasant castle, whither he had gone with a small following, both for the purpose of hunting and in order to take some repose. With him in his train was a certain Prince of Belos, as worshipful, virtuous, discreet and handsome a prince as any at court. The wife he had married did not belong to a family of high rank, yet he loved her as dearly and treated her as well as it were possible for a husband to do, and also trusted in her. And when he was in love with anybody he never concealed it from her,
knowing that she had no other will than his own. Now this prince conceived a deep affection for a widow lady called Madame de Neufchâtel, who was reputed the most beautiful woman it were possible to see, and if the Prince of Belhoste loved her well, his wife loved her no less, and would often send and bid her to dinner, for she deemed her so discreet and honorable, that, instead of being grieved by her husband's love for her, she rejoiced to see him address his attentions to one so full of honor and virtue. This affection lasted for a great while, the Prince of Belhoste caring for all the lady's affairs as though they were his own, and his wife doing no less. By reason, however, of her beauty many great lords and gentlemen earnestly sought the lady's favor, some only for love's sake, others for sake of the ring, for, besides being beautiful, she was also very rich. Among the rest was a young gentleman, called the Lord des Chariots, who wooed her so ardently that he was never absent from her levee and couchy, and was also with her as much as possible during the day. This did not please the Prince of Belhoste, who thought that a man of such poor estate, and so lacking in grace, did not deserve an honorable and gracious reception, and he often made remonstrances about it to the lady. She, however, being one of Eve's daughters, excused herself by saying that she spoke with everyone in general, and that their own affection was the better concealed, since she never spoke more with one than with another. Albeit, after some time, this Lord des Chariots so pressed her that, more through his importunity than through love, she promised to marry him, begging him, however, not to urge her to reveal the marriage until her daughters were wedded. After this the gentleman was wont to go with untroubled conscience to her chamber at whatsoever hour he chose, and none but a waiting woman and a serving man had knowledge of the matter. When the prince perceived that the gentleman was growing more and more familiar in the house of her whom he so dearly loved, he took it in ill part, and could not refrain from saying to the lady, "I have always prized your honor like that of my own sister, and you are aware of the honorable manner in which I have addressed you, and the happiness that I have in loving a lady as discreet and virtuous as yourself, but did I think that another who deserves it not could win by importunity that which I am not willing to crave, contrary to your own desire, this would be unendurable to me, and in the like degree dishonoring to you. I tell you this because you are beautiful and young, and although hitherto of good repute, are now beginning to gain a very evil fame. Even though he be not your equal in birth or fortune, and have less influence, knowledge and address, yet it were better to have married him than to give all men matter for suspicion. I pray you, therefore, tell me whether you are resolved to love him, for I will not have him as fellow of mine. I would rather leave you altogether to him, and put away from me the feelings that I have hitherto borne you." The poor lady, fearful of losing his affection, thereupon began to weep, and vowed to him that she would rather die than wed the gentleman of whom he had spoken, but, she added, he was so importunate that she could not help his entering her chamber at a time when everyone else did so. "Of such times as those," said the prince, "I do not speak, for I can go as well as he, and see all what you are doing. But I have been told that he goes after you are in bed, and this I look upon as so extraordinary that, if you should continue in this mode of life without declaring him to be your husband, you will be disgraced more than any woman that ever lived." She swore to him with all the oaths she could utter that the other was neither her husband nor her lover, but only as importunate a gentleman as there well could be. "Since he is troublesome to you," said the prince, "I promise you that I will rid you of him." "What?" asked the lady. "Would you kill him?" "No, no," said the prince, "but I will give him to understand that it is not in such a place as this, not in such a house as the king's, that ladies are to be put to shame. And I swear to you by the faith of the lover that I am, that if, after I have spoken with him, he does not correct himself, I will correct him in such a manner as to make him a warning to others." So saying he went away, and on leaving the room failed not to meet the Lord des Chariots on his way in. To him he spoke after the fashion that you have heard, assuring him that the first time he was found there after an hour at which gentlemen might reasonably visit the ladies, he would give him such a fright as he would ever remember. And he added that the lady was of too noble a house to be trifled with after such a fashion. The gentleman protested that he had never been in the room except in the same manner as the rest, and, if the prince should find him there, he gave him full leave to do his worst. One day afterwards, when the gentleman believed the prince's words to have been forgotten, he went to see his lady in the evening, and remained sufficiently late. The prince, that same evening, told his wife that Madame de Neufchâtel had a severe cold, upon hearing which the worthy lady begged that he would visit her on behalf of them both, and make excuse for herself, since she could not go by reason of a certain matter that she must needs attend to in her room. The prince waited until the king was in bed, and then went to give the lady good evening, but as he was going up a stairway he met a serving man coming down, who, on being asked how his mistress did, swore that she was in bed and asleep. The prince went down the stairway, but, suspecting that the servant had lied, looked behind and saw him going back again with all speed. He walked about the courtyard in front of the door to see whether the servant would return. A quarter of an hour later he perceived him come down again and look all about to see who was in the courtyard. Forthwith the prince was convinced that the Lord de Chariots was in the lady's chamber, but through fear of himself durst not come down, and he therefore again walked about for a long while. At last, observing that the lady's room had a casement which was not at all high up, and which looked upon a little garden, he remembered the proverb which says, "When the door fails the window avails," and he thereupon called a servant of his own, and said to him, "Go into the garden there behind, and, if you see a gentleman come down from the window, draw your sword as soon as he reaches the ground, clash it against the wall, and cry out, 'Slay! Slay!' Be careful, however, that you do not touch him." The servant went whither his master had sent him, and the prince walked about until 3 hours after midnight. When the Lord de Chariots heard that the prince was still in the yard, he resolved to descend by the window, and, having first thrown clown his cloak, he then, by the help of his good friends, leapt into the garden. As soon as the servant saw him, he failed not to make a noise with his sword, at the same time crying, "Slay! Slay!" Upon this the poor gentleman, believing it was his, the servant's, master, was in such great fear that, without thinking of his cloak, he fled as quickly as he was able. He met the archers of the watch, who wondered greatly to see him running in this fashion, but he durst say nothing to them, except to beg them to open him the gate of the castle, or else to lodge him with themselves until morning. And this, as they had not the keys, they did. Then the prince went to bed, and, finding his wife asleep, awoke her saying, "Guess, my wife, what hour it is?" "I have not heard the clock strike since I went to bed," she replied. "It is 3 hours after midnight," said he. "If that be so," said his wife, "where have you been all this time? I greatly fear that your health will be the worse for it." "Sweetheart," said the prince, "watching will never make me ill when I am engaged in preventing those who try to deceive me from going to sleep." So saying, he began to laugh so heartily that his wife begged him to tell her of the matter. This he did at length, showing her the wolf skin, for which his servant had brought him. After making merry at the expense of the hapless lovers, they went to sleep in gentle tranquility, while the other two passed the night in torment, fearing and dreading lest the affair should be revealed. However, the gentleman, knowing right well that he could not use concealment with the prince, came to him in the morning when he was dressing to beg that he would not expose him, and would give orders for the return of his cloak. The prince pretended that he knew nothing of the matter, and put such a face on it that the gentleman was wholly at a loss what to think. But in the end he received a rating that he had not expected, for the prince assured him that, if ever he went to the lady's room again, he would tell the king of it, and have him banish the court. "I pray you, ladies, judge whether it had not been better for this poor lady to have spoken freely to him who did her the honor of loving and esteeming her, instead of leading him by her dissimulation to prove her in a way that brought her so much shame." "She knew," said Gibeon, "that if she confessed the truth she would wholly lose his favor, and this she on no account desired to do." "It seems to me," said Longarine, "that when she had chosen a husband to her liking, she ought not to have feared the loss of any other man's affection." "I am sure," said Parlamente, "that if she had dared to reveal her marriage, she would have been quite content with her husband, but she wished to hide it until her daughters were wed, and so she would not abandon so good a means of concealment." "It was not for that reason," said Saffredent, "but because the ambition of women is so great that they are never satisfied with having only one lover. I have heard that the discreetest of them are glad to have three: one, namely, for honor, one for profit, and one for delight. Each of the three thinks himself loved the best, but the first two are as servants to the last." "You speak," said Oisel, "of such women as have neither love nor honor." "Madam," said Saffredent, "there are some of the kind that I describe, whom you reckon among the most honorable in the land." "You may be sure," said Hircan, "that a crafty woman will be able to live where all others die of hunger." "And," said Longarine, "when their craftiness is discerned, 'tis death." "Nay, 'tis life," said Simontault, "for they deem it no small glory to be reputed more crafty than their fellows. And the reputation of crafty, gained thus at their own expense, brings lovers more readily under subjection to them than does their beauty, for one of the greatest delights shared by those who are in love is to conduct the affair slyly." "You speak," said Denis Sweet, "of wanton love, for the honorable has no need of concealment.
Ah, said Dagosin, I pray you put that thought out of your head. The more precious the drug, the less should it be exposed to the air, because of the perverseness of those who trust only to outward signs. These are not different in the case of honorable and faithful affection than in any other case, so they must none the less be hidden when the love is virtuous than when it is the opposite. If one would avoid the evil opinion of those who cannot believe that a man may love a lady in all honor, and who, being themselves slaves to pleasure, think everyone else the same. If we were all of good faith, look and speech would be without concealment, at least toward those who would rather die than take them in an evil sense.
I protest to you, Dagosin, said Hircan, that your philosophy is too deep for any man here to understand or believe. You would have us think that men are angels, or stones, or devils.
I am well aware, said Dagosin, that men are men and subject to every passion, but there are some, nevertheless, who would rather die than that their mistresses should, for their delight, do aught against their consciences.
To die means a great deal, said Gipuron. I would not believe that of them were it uttered by the lips of the austerest monk alive.
Nay, I believe, said Hircan, that there is none but desires the very opposite. But they make pretense of disliking the grapes when these hang too high to be gathered.
Still, said Nam Perfide, I am sure that the prince's wife was very glad to find that her husband was learning to know women.
I assure you it was not so, said Anna Sweet. She was very sorry on account of the love that she bore the lady.
I would as soon, said Saffredent, have the lady who laughed when her husband kissed her mate.
In sooth, said Anna Sweet, you shall tell us the story. I give place to you.
Although the story is very short, said Saffredent, I will still relate it, for I would rather make you laugh than speak myself at length.
Tale live.
_Tagus's wife, believing that her husband loved none but herself, was pleased that her serving woman should amuse him, and laughed when in her presence he kissed the girl before her eyes, and with her knowledge _. Between the Pyrenees mountains and the Alps, there dwelt a gentleman named Tagus, who had a wife and children, with a very beautiful house, and so much wealth and pleasure at his hand, that there was reason he should live in contentment, had it not been that he was subject to great pain beneath the roots of the hair, in such wise that the doctors advised him to sleep no longer with his wife. She, whose chief thought was for her husband's life and health, readily consented, and caused her bed to be set in another corner of the room directly opposite her husband's, so that they could neither of them put out their heads without seeing each other. This lady had two serving women, and often when the lord and his lady were in bed, they would each take some diverting book to read, whilst the serving women held candles, the younger, that is, for the gentleman, and the other for his wife. The gentleman, finding that the maid was younger and handsomer than her mistress, took such great pleasure in observing her that he would break off his reading in order to converse with her. His wife could hear this very plainly, but believing that her husband loved none but herself, she was well pleased that her servants should amuse him. It happened one evening, however, when they had read longer than was their wont, that the lady looked towards her husband's bed where was the young serving maid holding the candle. Of her she could see nothing but her back, and of her husband nothing at all excepting on the side of the chimney, which jutted out in front of his bed, and the white wall of which was bright with the light from the candle. And upon this wall she could plainly see the shadows both of her husband and of her maid, whether they drew apart, or came near together or laughed, it was all as clear to her as though she had veritably beheld them. The gentleman, using no precaution since he felt sure that his wife could not see them, kissed her maid, and on the first occasion his wife suffered this to pass without uttering a word. But when she saw that the shadows frequently returned to this fellowship, she feared that there might be some reality beneath it all, and burst into a loud laugh, whereat the shadows were alarmed and separated. The gentleman then asked his wife why she was laughing so heartily, so that he might have a share in her merriment. "Husband," she replied, "I am so foolish that I laugh at my own shadow." Inquire as he might, she would never acknowledge any other reason, but, nevertheless,